Good morning. Today is the day that we take a respite from topics deep, heavy, and philosophic, and instead we talk about beauty. The best way for me to open the topic, of course, is to offer you a story. But this is not the performance version of a story. If you go to the bookstore, you'll see a CD called Stories of Love. And on it, there is a 55-minute tale called The Dame Ragnell, otherwise known as The Loathly Lady, one of the ancient mythic mirrors of the Beauty and the Beast story. It was written in the 1400s by Cratin de Troyes, a famous French courtly poet. And it is one of the earliest of the feminist stories. And I will paraphrase it for you so that we don't take 55 minutes, but instead we just take a few. It is set in the days of King Arthur. And King Arthur is out in the woods hunting a stag, and he separates himself by a quarter mile from his hunting troop. He'll blow his bugle, he says, when he's felled the stag. All he is armored with is a bow and arrow and a dagger. And all at once, thundering into the clearing, is a huge knight with his sword drawn on an armored horse, poised to charge. And Arthur knows he has no chance to survive such an encounter at all. It turns out that the knight is Sir Gromet Sommejour. But he doesn't reveal himself until a few minutes of conversation has passed. He threatens to kill Arthur there alone and defenseless in the wood. Sir Gromet has had his lands confiscated recently by the young High King of England. And all his lands have been given to a certain knight named Sir Gawain. Sir Gawain is the most genteel and handsome of all the knights. "Kill me then," says Arthur. "I'm not afraid to die." And Sir Gromet says, "I no longer want your life, your gold. I want your sorrow and your confusion." And so they converse in these voices. At last, Arthur says, "Then kill me." But Sir Gromet says, "I will not kill you. If you can answer, in 1 year's time, having returned to this glade alone and unarmed, a simple question." Arthur can't believe he's about to be spared. He asks, "What is the question?" And Sir Gromet sits back on his saddle and laughs and says, "Oh, it is the question every man wants to answer, but no one can. What does a woman desire most?" At first, an idea flies into Arthur's mind, and he thinks he knows the answer, but then another occurs, and then more and more, and a flood of answers enters his mind, until at last Sir Gromet says, "Promise me in 1 year's time you'll return, and if you do not have the correct answer, you will hang your head like so, and I will lop it off like cheese." Well, Arthur has no choice and agrees to the answer, and morose and worried, he returns to Camelot, and there he meets Sir Gawain, who he had been hunting with Gawain, and Gawain realizes that a change has swept the High King. He becomes moody. He won't talk to anyone. He won't talk to Guinevere. He refuses to attend to the affairs of state until finally handsome young Sir Gawain comes up and says, "My lord, I've noticed a great change has swept you." And that's how he speaks. Well, finally, Arthur tells him what took place in the wood, that he must return in 1 year's time with the answer to this passing strange question, or else, if he's incorrect, lose his head. And his honor demands that he go. Well, Gawain looks at him and asks, "This is the question?" And Arthur says, "Yes, what is the answer? Is it love? Is it the health of one's children? Is it a fine home? Is it a handsome man? Is it satins? Is it stables, wealth? Or what do you think?" And Gawain sits back and says, "Oh, I think it's best to ask a woman, sire." Or perhaps many. This has not occurred to Arthur. So, Sir Gawain suggests that the two of them take steeds and ride off to foreign lands. And everywhere they stop, each having a blank book, write down all the answers to the question. Ask women what it is they most desire. Return, and surely, Gawain says, one answer will appear again and again. Tell that to Sir Gromet, and Arthur will be free of this. And Arthur says, this is the most wonderful idea I've ever heard, and the two of them gallop off. However, as the year progresses, they discover that indeed, the question elicits all manner of answers. Some women do indeed want a fine home. Others would prefer a lusty man in bed. Some, of course, wish for the health of their children. Others would demand little more than health and happiness and a simple life. And so as the books fill with answer after answer, the two men grow somewhat forlorn. And they return after a year's time, and poor Arthur looks at all the answers, and he feels the sword of Sir Gromet upon the back of his neck, and begins to grow very concerned, and says, oh, I don't know what to make of all these answers. Well, what shall I do? I think I shall go to Inglewood Forest, and that is the glade where he was originally accosted by Sir Gromet, and thinks that perhaps by being there in that same place a year later, some meditation will enable him to choose amongst all the answers. So he returns alone, and it is there that he meets the Dame Ragnell. He's on his horse, and suddenly he hears a voice.
Ooh, wedded for your life, Arthur!
He turns around, and there he beholds a woman. And as far as Arthur is concerned, and you should read the description in the poem that Chrétien de Troyes offered about what ugliness is, all of that is encapsulated in this particular woman. She has fangs, they're quite yellow, much more so than teeth ordinarily would be, and they're longer than they should be. Her complexion resembles that of a whipped man's back. Her bosom resembles loaded wine casks, and she bends the spine of her palfrey pony terribly. Her complexion is scabbed, and she looks at him with great bloodshot eyes between cheeks the size one sits on, and on and on and on. And she smells. And she rides up to Arthur, and she tells him that she knows why he's there. He tells her, go away, foul woman.
Oh, wedded for your life, Arthur.
He's horrified. And she says that she, however, knows the answer. What does a woman desire most? He says, how do you know that? Do you know Sir Gromet? And she says, perhaps, and perhaps I'll tell you the answer once we've traded. He asks, traded what? And she says,
oh, love. For life, your life for a love for me.
She demands to marry one of his knights. He examines them all in his mind's eye and wonders which one should be churlish enough to provide a mate for the Dame Ragnell, but none of them seems to work. But nevertheless, she says she's already chosen the one she demands, and it is, of course, Sir Gawain. And he says, no, I can't ask him to do that. I cannot command one of my knights to marry you. And she quickly says, oh, no, no, please do not. But if of his own free will, he agrees to marry me, I will tell you the answer. Meet me here 1 hour before you are to meet Sir Gromet, and if Gawain agrees, I will save your life, and so will he. So Arthur rides back to Camelot. And there's handsome young Gawain at the drawbridge. Oh, what news, sire? Arthur gets off his horse and walks over and says, well, I have something I have to confess. Oh, what is it? Well, I met a woman in the wood today. The foulest woman ever I've seen. Oh, that's a pity. Yes, but she'll tell me the answer, the one we've been seeking all this year. But first, she wants a husband. And he says, oh, find her one. It's not so simple. She wants you. And Gawain says, that, it does not matter. Whatever, however she looks, I will marry her. That my entire life has been made by you, King Arthur, and I will be happy to marry her. And Gawain says, and I'd suffer hells of any description for you. And he says, I'm not sure if I can describe this one. And so it is that Gawain, unsight unseen, agrees to marry the Dame Ragnell. Arthur returns an hour before he is to meet Sir Gromet and says, yes, Gawain has agreed to marry you. And she says,
ooh, that's a lovely outcome.
And then she proceeds to ask him,
what does a woman desire most? Is it love? A fine house? Servants? Children? What is it?
He says, well, hurry up and tell me, woman, what is it? And she says,
I don't like that.
Well, tell me.
Are you telling me what to do?
Well, of course. And she says,
but that's the very problem. Men telling us what to do.
And she tells him that the answer to the mysterious question is, what does a woman desire most? It is simply to be free, she says, free of men's control, to make a woman's own decisions for herself. Arthur's astonished at this. He says, well, I never thought of that.
No, you never thought of it.
And so it is that she says, now you tell Sir Gromet this and he will spare your life, but he will curse me. And he asks, you do know Sir Gromet? And she nods and says, oh, yes, I do. And then the next day she says, I will arrive and I will marry Sir Gawain. Well, Sir Gromet thunders up after the Dame Ragnell is left on her beautiful palfrey pony and draws his sword and says, well, now, tell me your answer. I want to get this over with so I can go home. And Arthur tells him the correct answer. Sir Gromet is astonished and says, oh, the Dame Ragnell, that hag, my sister, how did she know this? She told you this. Now I cannot kill you. No, you can't. And then Sir Gromet is afraid that he will be killed, and Arthur will pursue him to the ends of at least England. But Arthur says, no, but the next time we meet, I shall be armed. And at that point, Sir Gromet says, in that case, have a nice day. And off he rides. And the next day, at the bridge that leads into Inglewood Forest, who should appear upon her palfrey pony but the Dame Ragnell? She will not control what she says at all, and she decides that she will ride in and be married in the very chapel where Guinevere and Arthur were married. And Arthur says, well, you know, there's a small chapel off in the corner.
No! I want to be married with all the fine ladies and have a feast in the hall of the round table.
Horrified at this prospect, he nevertheless takes her in, and she rides, instead of dismounting, right up the steps into the hall at Camelot, where all the knights are assembled, and there is Sir Gawain. And he sees her, and he's gracious, and he helps her down from her pony. And she says,
oh, God of mercy, you're a lovely man. It's a shame I'm not a little prettier, but it does not matter.
All the other knights exit as quickly as they can. Guinevere squeezes Arthur's hand so hard he has to mention it. And the Dame Ragnell says,
and we'll be married today.
And Gawain looks at her, so soon?
Oh, yes. And we'll get to know each other tonight.
Ladies in waiting begin to weep, goblets fall to the floor. But nevertheless, the bishop prepares a wedding and the cook prepares a feast. And the Dame Ragnell and Sir Gawain are married. The feasting scene is hilarious. She eats 3 meat pies, 10 chickens, loaves of bread. She drinks wine direct from the decanter. She belches, and she has what can only be called a plenitude of nose crumbs, which she wipes across her cheeks, to the horror of everyone in the hall. Gawain is polite the entire time and compliments her on her beautiful wedding gown and removes chunks of food from her lap. Until at last, the feast is over, and she stands up and says,
"Oh, I feel lusty."
At that point, everyone else in the room exits. And so, they go to the wedding chamber with brocades and tallow candles and the whole business. And she looks at him and says, "Now that we are married, you must take me to bed." And he looks at her and says, "And I shall, lady." She looks at him and asks, "You will?" And he says, "You must realize that my life is dedicated to my king. And besides, although you're not the loveliest of women, perhaps there are things in your soul that can warm mine. Things beyond mere appearances. Things I know not of." And as soon as he says those words, her voice changes. And she changes. And he finds standing before him a beautiful maiden. And he demands to know, "Who are you? Where has she gone?" And the Dame Ragnell says, "I am your wife." "No, that's impossible. You married me this very day." "No, I married a hag today." "Oh, did you like the way I ate?" And he realizes it is the same person. He demands an explanation. And she tells him that her stepmother has cursed her to be as she was until the best man in England, of his own free will, married her. And he is thrilled. He takes her in his arms. He starts to kiss her. She's beautiful. Their hearts begin to pound. He looks over at the bed, but then she pushes him away. She says, "It is not so simple as this. The curse is cruel. Either you can have me as I am now, by night, in your bed. But by day, I will be the thing you married. And you can tell no one, and your friends will never know. Or by night, I will be the hideous version of myself. And in the day, you can walk proudly with me, and all your friends will say, 'Ah, there goes Gawain with his beautiful wife.'" And she says, "You must choose, husband." He takes a seat. And he imagines his life in his mind. And then finally says, realizing it's her body, "No, lady, I can't make that choice for you. You choose." And as soon as he says that, she yelps with joy. And she runs up to him and kisses him. And she tells him that was the last cruel condition of the curse, and that now that he has freed her to choose for herself, she can be beautiful for him all the time. And so ends the Dame Ragnell in its abbreviated version. Now, in this story, thank you. Now, in this exquisite old story from the 1400s, there are two kinds of beauty at work, it strikes me. There is the notion of outer beauty, but both for Gawain and for the Dame Ragnell, the waters of inner beauty seem to run far deeper, and in the end, trump all of it. And so what I thought I would do is just offer some ideas to you, I don't know whether you'll be familiar with them or not, about what I've discovered is the way that we human beings seem to respond to beauty, even as newborns. Charles Darwin had a second cousin. His name was Francis Galton. Francis Galton was a child prodigy, born of a wealthy English country family, the son of a doctor, who as a child loved to count things. He was a mad counter and a mad arranger of the data that he collected. As he developed, he became the inventor of a great many significant things. He had there's a great flaw at work in his character, which I'll get to momentarily, but nevertheless, he was responsible for the fact that fingerprinting in forensics is used as an identification science. He's the first one to figure out how to do that scientifically. He coined the term nature or nurture. He created the bell curve and standard deviations and all the statistical ways to analyze distributions of data. He was an adventurer, went to Africa, went all over the world. He was a naturalist. He was what was called a polymath, a very interesting person. He was also absolutely taken with the fact that his mind could do this and ended up part of what was the eugenics movement. Eugenics, of course, the selective breeding of human beings to better the conditions of the race, quote unquote. And his ideas were used later on by none other than the eugenicists in the National Socialist movement. And so that's a bit of a besmirchment upon his reputation, but Darwin was the very same way. In any event, what he did was a few experiments, and what he would do is he would take photographs of criminals and then superimpose them over photographs of ordinary people, and he would show ordinary people like us all these different photographs with the faces moving in and out and changing and features slightly different, and he discovered that people thought that the composites were often more beautiful than the originals, and that people seem to respond to a certain mathematical relationship of features that they considered to be beautiful. And it was at that point that he realized that these relationships that people thought, this is just faces, this has nothing to do with sunsets, flowers, beautiful weather, beautiful music, just faces, he determined that there was a mathematical relationship, which has been around for a long, long time. Pythagoras knew of it. Johannes Kepler called it the precious ratio, the precious jewel. It's called phi. It's a cousin of pi. You know, pi is the irrational number that will help you determine the area of a circle, pi r squared. Archimedes, the wonderful Syracusan Greek mathematician, figured out how to make the area of a circle. He was so smart. You know, you have a circle like this, and first he got, okay, well, that polygon has four edges, but I still have this stuff I don't know about. Then he made an eight-sided one, and then a 16, and then a 32, and he continued to make polygons of so many sides that they began to approach the edges, of course, of the circle, until he got to the point where if you reach the limit, or the infinite number of sides of the polygon, you have the area of the circle. And that's how he did it and discovered pi, which is the irrational number. You can calculate pi, it'll go on forever. It's one of those irrational numbers. And so is phi. Now, phi is found in the central whorl of sunflowers, in the growth pattern of leaves along stems. It is found in the Acropolis. It's called the golden section, the golden mean, the divine section. It's a universal nature design form. And this is how it's derived. Fibonacci was a famous mathematician, and he discovered the formula for the famous Fibonacci's number. It's the sum of the two previous numbers. So it goes one, the sum, and then one and two, and the sum of one and two is three. So then you add the two and the three, and you have five. So the next number is five. Then you add the three to the five, and the next is eight. Then you add the five and the eight, and the next is 13, and so on. And if you divide those numbers by the previous one, you end up with a very interesting series. I'll read it to you. And this is how the golden mean is derived. You're back there saying, I thought he was talking about beauty. Now we're hearing math. What is this? I'm working my way toward a point. 2 over 1 is 2, 3 over 2 is 1.5, 5 over 3 is 1.666, 8 over 5 is 1.6, 13 over 8 is 1.625, 21 over 13 is 1.615538, 34 over 21, these are all Fibonacci numbers divided by the one previously, is 1.61905. And if you all get all the way up to 89 55ths, you're at 1.6861. And if you keep going, just as pi does to infinity, you end up with phi, the golden section, the divine proportion. Euclid wrote about it. And lo and behold, Galton discovered that people were responding to it. Italian Renaissance architects, I'll read you a quote from one. Leon Battista Alberti, who lived from 1404 to 1472, wrote, quote, "When you make judgments on beauty, you do not follow mere fancy, but the workings of a reasoned faculty that is inborn in the mind." It's an interesting assertion, isn't it? The Renaissance architects knew fully well that if long as the width and the height of a building, or of porticos, or of windows, or of colonnades divided and added to one another was 1.6, people would be delighted by it and consider it more beautiful than not. And so the question arose in some Englishmen's minds, why is this? Even newborn babies will respond to this. Phyllotaxis is the growth of plants, and Fibonacci's spiral is in the phyllotaxis of the growth of plants. It's in the great spiral galaxies. And it also seems to be an organizing principle because you can most efficiently pack things in a Fibonacci whorl. If you go home and you find yourself in your garden and there's a big sunflower whorl, take a look at it. That's a classic Fibonacci spiral. All derived from this interesting ancient design form that nature itself seems to have created, and that we humans, perhaps over a few million years of looking at such things, have internalized. Who knows? There is a very interesting new science called neuroaesthetics. It's been around for about 5 years. You know that nowadays there are methods by which brain scientists can watch the brain at work, watch which regions of the brain are heating up with what's called cortical activity. And it used to be in the early days of brain research that you would cut open this gray matter and it was just this dense gray matter with different sinuses and odd bundles, and they had no idea what anything did in the brain until patients came in and they'd been severely injured, for instance. And suddenly they had a giant deficit and they could listen and remember, but they could not speak. And this part of their brain had been injured, so the scientist said, aha, okay, this part of the brain does that. Some of them, in order to treat epilepsy, would sever what's called the corpus callosum, a big bundle of fibers that connects your right hemisphere to your left. And then they found that people really were of two minds. And that they really didn't know, certain people didn't know what the other mind was doing. One hand would be doing this, the other hand would be doing this, thinking completely different thoughts. Which goes to an interesting, strange theory that fell out of favor, but recently, because of neuroaesthetics, has been coming back into currency. And that is the theory of Julian Jaynes, that he wrote about in the 1970s, and the origin of consciousness and the bicameral mind. This is a fascinating idea. I don't know whether to credit it or not. But Jaynes posited that before about 3,000 years ago, the human brain was bicameral, two houses. It's like the House of Representatives and the Senate. Our bicameral legislature. Only he posited that the human brain didn't, that the two sides of the brain, just as if you had had your corpus callosum severed, the reason they did that was to prevent seizures, which are racing signals going back and forth in epilepsy. So doctors sliced it. They also did lobotomies like this too, but we won't go there. So Jane said the explanation for the voices of the gods speaking to ancient peoples, so that they were able to organize these vast religions like the Mayans and the Aztecs, and they all did what they were told, was that the minds had not yet joined, and that the unitary consciousness that each of us has, and we just take for granted, I am here, you are there. And within each of you, there's probably, hopefully, at least just one at the moment. There may be more, but for let's just say that for the moment, we'll all agree that you are there, and I'm sitting here, and each of us is an individual. James said, no. Back in 3,000 years ago or so, when the gods always were speaking to people, he used Homer's Iliad and Odyssey as prime literary examples of this. He didn't have any scientific basis, because all the brains are long gone. Nevertheless, his idea was that people heard the voices of the gods all the time, because the right hemisphere was speaking, and the left was listening, and the left was doing what the right one told it to do. Much as in modern schizophrenia, one hears all manner of voices. Son of Sam is being rehabilitated. I just read it on the Times. He heard the voice of some dark Labrador that told him to go shoot people. Very interesting stuff. But back to beauty. So, if Galton was right, then that explains why, if you go online and you Google beauty, the first listings that you will discover will not be scholarly articles about beauty. They will be the sites of plastic surgeons. Try it. And what you will find is that on each of those sites, if they're smart plastic surgeons, they're talking about the golden section. They're talking, and they have maps of human faces. Oh, if you want a face with a golden mean, we'll do that, and you will look as this ideal is presented by nature. I really am very suspicious of that. But nevertheless, that is the rationale that many of these high-end operations are using. Does anyone want to toss out a thought about this? This is a strange and wondrous topic, I find. Does it make sense so far? Sir? It's very interesting. Here's something that the BBC reported. Babies look longest at faces with smooth skin, round eyes, plump lips, and symmetry. A beautiful face activates reward circuitry in our brains. Dopamine from the nucleus accumbens. Dopamine creates a sense of pleasure, which tends to make us repeat any activity. Dopamine after eating, mating, or fight or flight responses. Any survival reaction that, of course, is successful will release dopamine into your system. So does cocaine. And so does witnessing, it seems, beauty. It just makes us feel the same sense of happiness or something, dopamine level-wise, that that a drug does or eating a good meal does. It's very curious what the scientists have discovered. And if you suffer from anhedonia, which means that you are incapable of experiencing pleasure any longer, no matter what you do, if you are anhedonic, you have a profound dopamine deficiency, according to doctors. And often they will treat you thusly. Yeah, Kepler, calling it the precious jewel. Just a very... Now, of course, that is only one notion of beauty. I think that if you see a beautiful sunset, you probably won't demand that it follow some sort of hidden design form of the golden mean. I think that if you hear a piece of beautiful music, but although one could perhaps, and I haven't done this yet, suggest that the certain harmonic relationships that musical notes have to one another might well somehow conform to the golden mean auditorily. I don't know that. That would be a speculation. I mean, this sound probably doesn't. I don't know. Anyone else have a thought about this curious topic? Sir.
Well, conditioning and shaping, but it's part of it is cultural conditioning and shaping, and part of it, that mix across genetic to cultural, and they're all, it's the feedback loop, it's the conversation, it's the way of making sense of it.
His comment is that it's really, it's a culturally based feedback loop, which is indeed so. There are so many different kinds of beauty. The one that Galton studied was simply English beauty. That's just one small category of it. But yes, culturally defined indeed. And what one grows up with will determine the nature of it. It feeds back into genetics as well. Ah. And over how many generations would you speculate? And I'm sure that he's correct. Ma'am.
Yeah. I'll say this with as much modesty as I can muster. I grew up a really ugly child. And suddenly, in my teens, I changed. I was the first runner-up for Miss Indiana. And suddenly, everything came my way. I don't know that I had anything to do with that, but jobs opened up very quickly. The whole perception of people liking me changed. Over a lifetime, I have been both ugly and pretty. And the response is predictable.
You all heard her? Yes? Very interesting indeed. Sir.
Really good book, tying together the old mean and music, specifically Johann Sebastian Bach, is called Rebell Escher Bach, Eternal Old Breaks. So there is a lot of use of the old mean in music appreciation as well, and it ties together beauty and architecture as well.
Thank you. Now, that's a Douglas Hofstetter wrote Gödel, Escher, Bach. Escher, M.C. Escher, you know, Gödel was a famous mathematician who said no system can define itself from within, and Bach was Bach. Man.
There was a study done on, I think it was at Harvard, a female freshman, very plain looking, one of the fraternities rushed her without her knowing it, and she would come to the cafeteria, and one of the guys in the fraternity walking down the path, one of the other guys would go, "Wow, you look really good today." They kept doing this and noticing her. When she went home on Christmas break, her parents didn't recognize her because she had come here.
Wow. What a beautiful story, sir. Oh, goodness.
One of the interesting things out of clay, and I did the right side first. But I had pictures of the right side and the left side. And then I said, well, now I just have to make the left side like the right side, and it's perfect. Well, that's not perfect. So when I looked at the pictures that I had taken of my left side, it was way different than when I sculpted, so I had to change the whole sculpture. So your right side and your left side are different.
I think any actress in Hollywood will know that. Yes, this is my best side. Please. Here. What's your name? Yours? Yes. I don't know if you could all hear Carolyn, but she told an anecdote about a woman who had a brain hemorrhage and lost communication between the two hemispheres of the brain and talked differently, thought differently, and really had two separate minds. That's fascinating. Yes. Jill Bolton Taylor, and the book is?
A Stroke of Insight.
A Stroke of Insight. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, we are a couple of minutes over our time. I invite you to come back at 3:15 in the Brandy room, and we can continue this conversation. Have a good morning.